What was it like to live through the worst pandemic in our history? What lessons can we learn walking in the footsteps of those who lived through the great influenza pandemic of 1918? This week on 880 In Depth, we take a trip through time. What was it like living in 1918? What did we learn from the great flu pandemic? And what did we fail to learn?
Frankly, there are hundreds of thousands of Americans who should be alive, who are dead, because of messaging problems.
Welcome to 880 In Depth. I'm Tim Schild. Two facts about the 1918 Great Influenza Pandemic stand out to me. More people died from that flu outbreak around the world than were killed in all of World War I. And that one year of death in our country, 1918, lowered the average life expectancy by 12 years. Wow. 12 years. In just a bit, we'll hear the thoughts of how that pandemic relates to the one we're living through today with author and professor John M. Barry. But first, we wanted to get a better feel of what it was like living in New York 100 years ago, just how the great waves of flu back then affected society. Come with us to the Lower East Side of Manhattan, 97 Orchard Street to be exact, the Tenement Museum, today a National Historic Landmark, which tells the story of American immigrants who built the country we live in today. Our tour guide up the tight winding stairs of this five-story brick building is David Favolaro, Senior Director of Curatorial Affairs for the Tenement Museum. He took our Peter Haskell on the tour.
It was in 1919. Yes, men and women was dead. We must go. We should go.
Do you want to walk up the stairs?
Yeah, sure.
Give it a nice hard walk.
Any trouble picking up sounds on these stairs.
Kind of a narrow staircase.
It's a little narrow. It takes a little bit of effort to get up here on the third floor of 97 Orchard Street. Is a five-story building.
What's it made of, and when was it built?
Now, 97 Orchard Street was built in 1863 and inhabited as a residence until 1935. The building was, you know, effectively condemned in 1935 because of the staircase we just walked up, which was by that point in time considered a fire hazard, so had to be replaced with fireproof materials. The landlord decided he did not want to do that for several different reasons and instead evicted all of the residents of the building.
In 1918, was this a nice building, a bad building, a middle building? How would you describe it?
This was a typical building on the Lower East Side, home to working class immigrants, mostly from Eastern Europe, Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe who had arrived, you know, over the several preceding decades, beginning in, say, the 1880s or 1890s. And really settling here in a building like this as a kind of first home. But this is also, by that point in time, right, by the early 20th century, by the 19-teens, a 50-year-old building that had been inhabited by thousands of newcomers from Europe. The family who called this apartment home, their name was Rogoshevsky. They were Lithuanian, or what today is Lithuania, then the Russian Empire, Jewish immigrants who arrived here around the turn of the century. But it's also typical for what these homes might have looked like for other Jewish immigrant families from Eastern Europe. And on the tour in which we tell the story of the 1918 influenza epidemic, we use this space to explore the story of the Baronescu family. They were also East European Jewish immigrants. The father was originally from what is today Romania, the mother from what is today Russia. And they, you know, they would have lived in a space that looked very much like this. Three rooms, 325 square feet, shared by, you know, about, in this particular case, seven individuals. So two parents and five children.
How old were the kids?
You know, they ranged in ages. And I think what's really interesting about this particular story is that the year in 1918, when the father, the sort of patriarch of this family, his name is Jacob Baronescu, when he becomes ill with the flu and ultimately dies from it in the beginning of November of 1918, his wife Sarah is pregnant, right? So much of what we know about this particular family story comes from oral history interviews conducted, you know, now some 30 years ago in the very early days of the museum with this child. Her name was Jenny, also known as Jacqueline, who was born after her father passed, right? So sort of never knew her father. And it's a really interesting story for her to sort of relate this, the story of her family, not only living here at 97 Orchard Street and her own story growing up here, but the stories passed down to her about her father, what he was like, what his life was like, and his ultimate battle and death from influenza in 1918.
The stories of immigrants who passed through this building and in this neighborhood are documented in the interviews with family members over the years who helped fill in the blanks. The daughter of Jacob Baronescu and her daughters told their stories to curator David Favolaro.
What they tell is that he was employed across the street and actually owned his own business. They actually gave us a copy of his business card, right? You know, so many of us have family photographs passed down in our own families, but I certainly don't have my ancestors, my great-grandfather's business card. It's really cool, right? So he owned, you know, what effectively would be like a cleaning business, what we would think of as maybe like dry cleaners of sorts in 92 Orchard Street just across the street here in the sort of basement area. And it seems, at least from the stories they've told us, that business was linked to his involvement in the Yiddish theater. He was kind of an amateur actor in the Yiddish theater, belonged to what they called a sort of amateur Yiddish theater acting troupe. And he would clean the uniforms, and the costumes from the Yiddish theater. The story passed down in the family is that he contracted the flu visiting some of his friends in the Yiddish theater who were on their sick beds tending to them. He was also, as they say, the kind of president of a society, which we've interpreted as you know, a president of a Landsmannschaft, maybe involved in the theater world, right? So he was actually tending to some of his friends and fellow actors, and that's where he contracted the flu. One of the things that's really interesting to me, I think, about both this story and about the history of the 1918 flu epidemic, right? Obviously, the flu is something we contend with every year, and this was very different in 1918, in part because folks like Jacob were the ones who ultimately were the most vulnerable, right? He was in his mid-30s when he passed, right? And so most of the folks, as you may know, right, who ultimately became sick and died were like in the prime of their lives, and you know, they're 25 to 40 years old.
Well, he killed the rich and poor, and he's going to kill some more.
Which leads us to the New York Times best-selling book, The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history.
Yet the story of the 1918 influenza virus is not simply one of havoc, death, and desolation, of a society fighting a war against nature superimposed on a war against another human society. It is also a story of science, of discovery, of how one thinks, and of how one changes the way one thinks, of how amidst near-utter chaos a few men sought the coolness of contemplation, the utter calm that precedes not philosophizing, but grim, determined action.
That's an excerpt from the Penguin Random House book read by Scott Brick. Today, the author, John M. Barry, is a professor at Tulane University School of Public Health and Medicine. He is a speaker in great demand because of his knowledge of the 1918 flu and his perspective at how it differs and compares to what we're living through today. He spoke to our Peter Haskell this week.
How has the course of COVID tracked with the pandemic from 1918? What's different? What's similar?
Well, there's a lot of both. Of course, the basics is a virus jumped species into humans. It spreads almost in the identical fashion. Droplets airborne. Both attack virtually every organ in the body, particularly neurological, cardiovascular, although they're primarily respiratory viruses. 1918 was much more lethal. Thankfully, we're not dealing with a virus as deadly as 1918. But COVID is much more transmissible, makes a lot more people sick. Two main differences. The target demographics in 1918 is primarily young people. There were two real peaks of high mortality, and that were young children under the age of 10, and then again people in their 20s, and it began to tail off. And in fact, well over 90% of the excess mortality was people younger than 65. Of course, COVID is exactly the opposite. Another really big difference is time. Everything about influenza, not only 1918, but generally in seasonal influenza, moves faster than COVID. You know, from incubation period, how long you shed virus, how long you're sick, and serial transmission. And these things add up. So both an ordinary seasonal influenza and in 1918, you're really talking about a period of weeks in any particular community. Probably two-thirds of the total death toll over a two-year period occurred in a period of about 14 or 15 weeks in the fall of 1918. And in any given city, it was actually faster than that, probably 6 to 10 weeks. And of course, we've been dealing with COVID for close on 2 years now, with no end in sight, unfortunately.
Back in 2004, Barry's work caught the eye of then President George W. Bush as his team was looking into pandemic preparedness. It helped that White House see through the lens of history how important truth and science are in fighting a global pandemic. We asked Barry, does he see missteps in the way we battled COVID-19? You bet.
You know, if for example, masks, you know, the masks are so important potentially in limiting the spread of the disease. And yet people object to wearing them. They're somewhat uncomfortable, but there's not a state in the country that doesn't have a law against smoking in public places, restaurants, bars, other public places. And the reason for those laws are because secondhand smoke can injure someone who's standing nearby. But that injury, which could cause cancer, takes years. to develop. Whereas, you know, you're talking about exposure over a few minutes that can kill you. And masks can help prevent that. So can vaccines. And the idea that you have opposition to on the so-called basis of, you know, it infringes on your individual freedom. I mean, so the anti-smoking ordinances, these things save lives. You know, how are they politicized? It's just, it's crazy. You know, seatbelt laws, where the only person you're going to hurt is yourself, and yet we have seatbelt laws. And here, these things can save not only the life of someone who's wearing a mask, not to mention the life of someone who gets vaccinated, but taking those actions would save other people's lives who are completely innocent, and yet people oppose them on political basis. Just nuts.
How do we undo this to reverse this? Can we undo this to reverse this?
Well, it's pretty difficult at this point. You know, you can't. How do you put Humpty Dumpty back together again? You know, it would have been very easy at the beginning, I think, for a unified approach to develop. And it would have been very much in Trump's political self-interest had he done that. In fact, the only time in his presidency that he cracked 50% in approval was a couple of days after he said we were at war with the virus. Had he maintained that position, you know, the country could have, I think, unified around this issue. There should be plenty of other politicization on other issues. But we've gone so far. If Omicron right now, thank God, Omicron looks like it might be certainly no more severe, but maybe even less severe than the variants that have gone before, which incidentally, you know, that's another great similarity is the development of variants. You know, if we go back to 1918, you want to get into that in a second. You know, but, you know, had Omicron, and let's hope it doesn't, you know, turned out to be even scarier than it may be, then you have a chance of unity again. We can only, I think it's probably too late this time around. We can only hope that next time, and there will be a next time, there will be future pandemics, that next time whoever is in charge realizes that how important unity is, and also how it's in their political self-interest to tell the truth, because over a period of time, only the truth, you know, people are going to figure it out if you're not telling the truth, and it'll destroy your credibility and hurt you politically.
So you talk about Omicron. We've got potentially other variants down the road. What does 1918 tell us about how many more of these things we could expect? And maybe more significantly, what's the likelihood that they're going to cause severe illness as opposed to just infection?
Well, I'm not sure 1918 tells us anything about that. You know, that's sort of the luck of the draw. These variants arise randomly. The mutations are random. I can tell you in 1918, they had a first wave that was extraordinarily mild, no worse than ordinary seasonal influenza, and it passed almost entirely unnoticed, except in retrospect. Then a variant developed that was much more transmissible than the first wave, but it was also much more lethal. However, it was very similar in other ways to the first wave. So if you got sick in the first wave, you actually had up to 94% protection against death, which is about as good as you're going to get. After that, second wave passed around the world, and again, very transmissible, infected, you know, much of the world. Then a third wave developed, another variant. In that case, it escaped the immune protection provided. If you got sick in either the first or second wave, you didn't have any protection whatsoever against the variant that caused the third wave. It was, however, less lethal than the second wave. It was still pretty dangerous. After that, another variant emerged, which, you know, some people think there are only three waves in 1918. Others argue that there were four. It's a question of semantics, really. Personally, I think there was primarily three. After that, the virus sort of adapted to the human population, and by 1921, it was like ordinary seasonal influenza. And descendants of the 1918 virus continue to circulate in the seasonal influenza viruses that we all are exposed to today. You might argue they're all been variants of 1918. They can kill you. There's no question about it. But they're nothing like the second wave of 1918, which is what we all think about. The reality is that there is no guarantee that COVID will behave the same way. We are now getting Omicron, which looks like it's much more transmissible than even Delta, but seems to be, on the early returns, less deadly on a per capita basis. But if it infects everybody, you're still going to get a lot of deaths. What comes next? There is no guarantee. There is no particular law of nature that says just because a virus becomes more transmissible, it's going to be less deadly. Back in 1918, again, that second wave was much more transmissible than the first wave, and it was much more deadly than any other influenza that we know about in the last several hundred years. With COVID, let's hope we've seen the worst of it already.
And about preparing for the next one, we asked John M. Barry.
Is it about domestic production? Is it about storing supplies? What kinds of things should the country be doing to be better prepared?
Well, it's all those things, but I would say number one would be public health infrastructure, which is, primarily a state and local expense. We are woefully underinvested in that. The investment in that has declined dramatically in the last 25 years. I would say that's number one. Stockpiling supplies and so forth. The Bush administration did create, actually there were hints of it in the Clinton administration, and then the Bush administration went all in and then creating what they call a strategic national stockpile, which included things like N95 masks and ventilators and some drugs. And most of those things were depleted significantly in 2009. The budget wars between the Republicans in the Congress, mostly the Tea Party, and the Obama administration meant that those things were never restored, replaced. And, along comes the Trump administration, which certainly didn't restore it in, for the first 3 years of its when they were in office. you know, you just need to recognize that public health is an investment worth making.
John, thanks for your patience, and thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
But it was God's own mighty plan. He is charging this old land, north and south, east and west, can be seen. Well, he killed the rich and poor, and he's going to...
John M. Barry's book, The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history, comes from Penguin Random House. You can find it on Amazon. And we highly recommend a visit to the Tenement Museum in Lower Manhattan for a wonderful historic visual trip into the city's rich past. For more there, visit tenement.org. Our thanks to Peter Haskell, to Dempsey Pilott, and to Fami Redwood for help in putting this week's In-Depth together. Find us wherever you get your audio. Search 880 In-Depth. Subscribe and listen to us on your time. And please tell a friend. I'm Tim Scheld. Thank you for listening, and please be safe.